assessment of the amount of munitions left over by different wars is impossible. Large numbers of these unexploded munitions are still discovered in places which used to be battlefields many decades ago. It's hard to believe that a century after the end of the First World War, munitions containing mustard gas from that period have just recently been unearthed. This chart depicting the amount of unexploded ordnance discovered in Berlin between 1947 and 2011 makes it clear that we should always expect to find leftover munitions in historical war zones. It appears the end of these unexploded munitions is nowhere in sight, even though the war they were used in ended 70 years ago. Landmines and explosive remnants of war are the terrifying legacy. Mines are cheap to produce and thus widely used in battles. They are indefinite activity, and the unknown nature of their numbers and locations have made the world unsafe for civilians decades after the end of the war. Landmines don't distinguish between soldiers and civilians. Each year, approximately 7,500 people are killed or injured by landmines and explosive remnants of war. Nearly one-third of those who survive such explosions suffer loss of limbs. An official UNICEF report on children killed by landmines states, "Children are the most vulnerable group at risk from landmines and unexploded ordnance. Their curiosity compels them to pick up strange unknown items in the hope of finding a new toy. Children in 60 countries are currently in danger of being killed by landmines. The risk from unexploded munitions is not just limited to accidents either. The people in some poorer regions collect these munitions in order to sell them or use the explosive materials inside. Unfortunately, such endeavors usually have deadly outcomes. Mines and explosive remnants of war have been widely used in Iran, Afghanistan, Angola, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Cambodia, Ethiopia, Iraq, Mozambique, Nicaragua, Somalia, Sudan, and many other war-stricken countries. All these countries are now grappling with the scourge of contaminated areas. Iran had no contaminated areas until 1980. However, the massive war which was about to start turned Iran into the second most contaminated country at the time. Iraq's Ba'ath regime invaded Iran in 1980 on orders of Saddam. Five of Iran's border provinces were under constant and heavy fire from Saddam's army for 8 years. After the Iraqi Ba'ath forces suffered multiple defeats in the first years of the war, Saddam resorted to defensive measures to stop the advance of Iranian forces. The Ba'ath army turned to attritional warfare by creating dense and layered minefields, building obstacles, wide trenches, and bombarding Iran's border provinces. The war ended after 8 years. In addition to all the destruction, Iran now had to start a new, quiet but longer war. Even though Iraqi forces had withdrawn from Iranian territory, Iran's fight against the leftover landmines and unexploded munitions had only just begun. Saddam had claimed that his soldiers would remain on Iranian soil even 50 years after the war ended. Khuzestan Province, 1,500,000 hectares. Ilam Province, 1,700,000 hectares. Kermanshah Province, 700,000 hectares. Kurdistan Province, 150,000 hectares. And West Azerbaijan Province, also 150,000 hectares. Between them, these contaminated lands cover an area larger than the whole of the Netherlands, Switzerland, and other 121 countries, around 4,200,000 hectares. The density of the Iraqi minefields left in Iran don't match conventional military standards. Some of these contaminated lands contain over 130 landmines per hectare, which is 2 to 3 times the amount commonly used in minefields around the world. Ilam Province, Mehran City. This region of Iran near the Iraqi border covers 300 hectares, 100 of which was turned into minefields by Iraq. Each of these red dots represents 4 landmines, meaning the Iraqi army planted 60,000 mines in this area. The demining operation in this region is still ongoing even after 30 years. Saddam's government used over 20 million landmines and several millions of explosive ordnance on Iranian soil. This made Iran the second most contaminated country at the time, after Egypt. Iranian armed forces would start the clearance of contaminated lands as they were liberating those occupied regions. The demining process continued for more than a decade after the end of the war, and a large part of the contaminated areas were eventually cleared. However, that method could not achieve complete clearance due to the problems caused by the passage of time and the return of civilians to the region. After the initial clearance, a group of experts named the Islamic Republic of Iran Mine Action Center was assembled to organize, implement, and oversee the necessary requirements for humanitarian demining activities. This group was tasked not only with systematic demining, but with educating civilians who were at risk in order to reduce the potential number of deaths. The group also needed to have the ability to communicate with other foreign and domestic institutions in order to expand international relations and convey the experience they had gained while clearing the minefields of Iran to the entire world. The geography and climate of each of the contaminated regions in Iran are quite different and diverse. Hot and arid plains, areas covered in sand, vast wetlands, deserts, high-altitude mountainous regions, forests, and pastures. These can all be found in Iran's 5 border provinces. Landmines and unexploded munitions are spread out throughout these regions, both close to the surface and buried deep underground. No one is willing to build their house, start a farm, take their herds grazing, invest money or establish a factory anywhere near a contaminated area. Life can't continue in a place where you can't trust the ground you stand on, even if that place is otherwise a paradise. The Islamic Republic of Iran Mine Action Center had a long path to complete demining ahead of it. Thank you. No one knows exactly how many landmines and unexploded ordnance are buried in the ground, and we therefore cannot know when the last one is removed and complete clearance is achieved. Both the surface and the depths of the ground need to be searched centimeter by centimeter. You would be hard-pressed to find anyone who believed that landmines and ordnance can move. But in fact, seasonal floods can carry these mines and munitions and dump them near a farm, or on the banks of rivers, or near a school. This means that previously cleared areas can become recontaminated. The river is impossible to completely demine because of the flooding and the trees around it. So the local residents must constantly be ready for the river to send them a deadly gift, even if they live kilometers away. The shifting sands create a new landscape every day here. These same shifting sands had made life tremendously difficult for the Iraqi forces during the war, because their very dense minefields were quickly buried under the dunes. They therefore had to build multiple minefields in the same place to stop the advance of Iranian forces. In some regions, up to 6 layers of mines were planted into the sand. The area of Chazzabeh is several square kilometers, and clearing it is extraordinarily difficult since every centimeter of the sands needs to be sifted through up to a depth of 6 meters. In addition, the sands shift and the height of the sand dunes changes almost every day. One thing the demining squads need to keep in mind is that the mines stay active for years under the sand, and sometimes become even more sensitive than before. The smallest mishandling can lead to an explosion. There is some probability of finding landmines in any area where military forces were once present, even if no conflict took place there. This is because minefields are designed to be obstacles for enemy forces, and any area considered to be a possible point of attack will be rigged with mines. Iraqi forces created minefields even in places that weren't a potential source of threat, and with high density, no less. A while ago, a man lost his leg after stepping on a mine, which the rain had moved down from this minefield. Every rainy season increases the chance of other areas being contaminated. If any of the clearance squad members is injured here, it'll take at least over an hour to get him to the nearest hospital, even in good weather.
We are with you. What about you? Real Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Administrative detainees held without charge or trial now represent more than a third of Palestinian child prisoners. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, Palestinian boys, mostly 15 to 17 years of age, but sometimes as young as 12, have long been targeted by the Zionist regime military for arrest, detention, and prosecution. The Zionist regime is the only regime in the world that automatically and systematically prosecutes children in military courts, with between 500 and 700 Palestinian children detained and prosecuted annually. An increasing number of those children have not been charged with any crime and are held under administrative detention orders. They are part of the largest cohort of Palestinian child administrative detainees in history. Since the Al-Aqsa storm operation on October 7, 2023, Israeli regime forces have seriously escalated their efforts to arrest Palestinians, including children, in large numbers. The most consistent source of prisoner numbers is the Israel Prison Service, which releases headcounts once a quarter, including breakdowns by age and charge, or lack thereof. Human rights groups like the One Defense for Children International, Palestine DCIP, monitor these numbers, document prison conditions, and collect testimony from prisoners. The numbers alone are alarming. For the last year, each time the Israel Prison Service has released headcounts, the number of Palestinian child detainees held in administrative detention was the highest it's ever been. The latest headcount, 112 Palestinian child administrative detainees, as the end of December, is almost five times the number of children held without charge prior to October 7, 2023. Child administrative detainees now represent more than one in three Palestinian child prisoners. Israeli regime forces have rapidly expanded their use of administrative detention to exert control over Palestinian children and families in the occupied West Bank. The Zionist regime authorities enacted harsh restrictions on access to Israeli prison after October 7. Family visits were suspended entirely, and visits from lawyers representing prisoners became extremely difficult, frequently rejected by the Zionist regime authorities. As a result, DCIP's lawyers have primarily collected testimony from children after their release from Israeli custody. All reported that prison conditions have deteriorated significantly, with Israeli prison guards regularly serving rotten food, denying access to toilets and showers, and crowding cells with twice the appropriate number of children. The food is poor quality, uncooked, and insufficient for us as children. It causes me difficulties because I suffer from stomach problems. That's what 16-year-old Jamal, who spoke under a pseudonym for safety reasons, told DCIP, describing the situation inside Ofer prison, adding, there is little comfort in the cell as there are not enough beds for everyone. Some of us are forced to sleep on the floor in shifts. The Zionist regime forces detained Jamal from his home in Arub refugee camp in southern occupied West Bank over the summer, after previously shooting him in the knee with live ammunition. On the date he was detained, he was scheduled to have surgery to repair the injury. Jamal told DCIP, "The soldiers exploited my injury, forcing me to sit and kneel on my wounded knee for 5 hours. I was severely beaten if I moved due to the pain," adding that the pressure caused his wound to reopen. Jamal said, "They put headphones on my ears and played songs at loud and annoying volume for an hour and a half, knowing that I suffer from weak hearing in my right ear, and this caused me pain in my left ear and head." Israeli regime interrogators are notorious for carrying out acts of physical and psychological cruelty against Palestinian child detainees in order to extract a confession. While international legal standards underscore that children accused of a crime have the right to have a family member and lawyer present with them during interrogation, Palestinian children are afforded neither. Jamal was never presented with charges. Instead, Israeli regime forces detained him pursuant to an administrative detention order. This meant that neither he nor his family had any idea when he would be released, what he was accused of, or even he would be able to go home. Now, as hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are finally being released as part of the true agreement between the fabricated regime of Israel and the resistance movement Hamas, some child prisoners are returning home to their families. The Zionist regime authorities are threatening their families in an effort to stop them from speaking on the media, yet another effort to isolate children and their families. The Israeli regime military's widespread and expanded use of administrative detention to target Palestinian children amounts to arbitrary detention and has no standing in international law. Until every Palestinian child is released from Israeli regime custody and this practice of targeting children is abolished, we must continue fighting to reunite children with their families.
Hello and welcome to Unscripted. I'm Kavit Hafwai. Palestinian doctor and five-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee Izzaddin Abu-Laish has experienced immense personal tragedy. In January 2009, an Israeli tank shell hit his home, killing his three daughters and one of his nieces. And in October 2024, 22 members of his extended family were killed in Jabalia refugee camp by an Israeli airstrike. Also known as the Palestinian doctor or Gaza doctor, he now joins us in this edition of Unscripted. Izzaddin Abu-Laish, welcome to Unscripted.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Before, during, and after, this is a timeline that I'm hoping this interview will take us through in terms of the journey that you've had. And I'd like to start out with the timeline before your book, which certain events led to you writing this book called I Shall Not Hate, A Gaza Doctor's Journey on the Road to Peace and Human Dignity. Now, we are aware of the fact that you have devoted your life to not only medicine, but also reconciliation between Israelis and Palestinians. Now, at the same time, there have been some wars. Aside from Operation Cast Lead back in 2008-09, the Pillar of Defense in 2012, and Protective Edge in 2014. Did any of these wars or anything else alter that devotion that you had when it came to Palestinian reconciliation with Israel?
Thank you so much. It's important to hope you read the book and to understand what is the story of the Palestinian people. The book, I Shall Not Hate, it's about a human universal story from where did I come as a Palestinian refugee and a descendant of parents who survived the Nakba. I am a refugee who was born, raised, and lived in Jabalia refugee camp in the teeming poverty, in the suffering, in the intimidation, the continuous, protracted, transgenerational and intergenerational trauma. But in spite of that, we as Palestinians, we are fighting just to survive. And when I wrote my book to show the world who are the Palestinians, who are hearing about the Palestinians. They are not supposed just to hear, to know who are the Palestinians. Palestinian people are people like others, with hopes, with the plans, with the dreams, with names, and they succeed, and they are achievers. And when I wrote this book after the tragedy of the killing of my daughters and my niece, even afterwards, when tens of my family members were murdered after what we call October 7, I said it clearly in my book, if I could know that my daughters were the last sacrifice in the way to peace. But what is peace? Peace is not just a word. Peace is a way of life. Peace is a relationship. It's about justice, about dignity, about freedom, about rights, about equality. Peace is not going to be achieved by war. War will never bring peace. We need to achieve justice, equality, dignity, freedom, and rights for all. And that's why when I wrote, I shall not hate, it means I will never be broken. I will never be defeated. I will never give up. I am more determined than before to continue to bring justice, freedom, dignity to my daughters and to my people.
Well, it's obviously very commendable that you have this passion that's very noticeable in your the way that you have delivered that to us. You could hear that in your voice. And that's what we want to find out from you, as I'm sure many, including Palestinians and non-Palestinians, regarding how you talk about justice, peace, and equality. I'd like to point out, to, if it's okay to talk about this, the time that the Israeli tank shell hit your home, which unfortunately led to the killing of your daughters back in 2009. If you're comfortable with this, I'm going to go ahead and ask the question, because it's really important to highlight how we understand this was broadcast live. You were supposed to appear on Israeli TV, from what we understand. Then it came to symbolize the war, based on how it was reported. And you said 2 days later, then Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who said knows you, announced a unilateral ceasefire. I'd like to find out your thoughts then, in terms of your viewpoint on Ehud Olmert, because he was responsible during the war at that point to order U.S. bombs to actually shell civilian Palestinian civilians. We know that some 1,400 were killed, including some 300 children. Do you think that he really had an emotion attached after what you came to function as when 2 days later a ceasefire was announced?
You know, it's important. What is war? War is not about the soldier who is going to kill and to be killed. War is about innocent human beings, about women, children who are sitting there and waiting to have life and to continue life. War is not to be documented, but to be prevented and to be avoided. And that's what is happening at that time in 2008 and 9, when we were under bombardment and continuous bombardment. Who is going to be next? I was the voice of the Palestinian people to spread to the message. And at that time, what is most painful? I lost faith in the humanity. The world is watching and was watching what happened in 2008, 2012, 14, 18, 21, 22, and 23 until now. They are watching it. We as Palestinians, we played the same color as others. We are human. It exposed the atrocities of the world and the bias and the indifference of the world, even complicit world. So at that time, I believe in every bad thing, there is something good. I am a person of faith. I believe in that. So I directed my face to God, and this tragedy, the killing of my daughter, came in the right time when I called my colleague, because I worked in Israel as a Palestinian doctor. I want the Israelis to know who are the Palestinians. And the Palestinians are human beings, and they give a humanity. And when it was broadcasted live, it helped in exposing the lies that we are killing the innocent human beings. These are the daughters of the doctor who delivered us, who helped us. And that's what is needed. And that's why when Ehud Olmert announced unilateral ceasefire. But do we need to be killed in order to save lives? We should save the life, because every human life is precious. War is not to be stopped. War is to be prevented and to be avoided, and to replace it with justice, with equality, with the freedom, with dignity, with rights, and to live by these values. Even what is happening these days after what we call it October 7, with this genocide, with this ethnic cleansing, with this mass destruction, mass displacement, mass starvation. Gaza Strip, now it's a ghost, it's a childless, it's helpless, it's foodless, it's homeless. Nothing is there under the witness of the world. It exposed this world, the hypocrisy and mediocrity of our world. Where are they from these human rights they are talking about by lip service? It's time to live by these values, not in a biased or indifferent or double standards. Palestinians are people like others, and that's what I see it in the world. It's a challenge to the world, and it's an opportunity to the world to start their change in their behaviors. What kind of world do we live in? Is it civilized? Is it human? I don't believe that. The administrations of what we call the Western civilized world, they are hypocritic, they are mediocritic, they are humanly,
sure,
ethically, morally, and spiritually bankrupt. And Gaza Strip put them under the test. And the test is there in Gaza Strip. It's time for the international community to live by these values. And the first thing to implement it for the Palestinians, and we need accountability and liability of the perpetrators. Accountability is essential, crucial for the dignity and to achieve justice and equality.
See, the things that you say obviously are very well noted here, and I don't think there's anybody that can disagree with that. What I'm trying to understand here from you, and I'm sure many others who will watch this, is to understand the mentality that the Israelis have versus the approach that you have. You know, we're looking at, for example, this previous wars, including this particular genocidal war, where there were high precision weapons that were used. These are weapons that are capable of pinpoint strikes that can hit within a meter of their targets. Why am I mentioning this? Is because there are many targets by the Israeli regime using technology such as what has been used in these weapons. But yet you have so many civilians that have been killed. The stats speak for themselves in terms of the genocidal war, which then puts into perspective and puts up the argument versus what you have said, that the Israeli regime doesn't really care about civilian lives. Do you think that that is a valid point to make here?
Yeah, it's when you speak about the weapons used, everything in life has been used, weaponized, militarized, politicized and normalized against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Everything, food, water, medications, health, schools, weapons, everything has been used against the Palestinians. But the Palestinian people are a living nation, and they will never give up or forget their rights. And the world, it's time for the world to understand it and to stand by justice to save the Palestinians from the atrocities of these weapons. These weapons, as I said, and those people who were murdered, who were killed in the sake of freedom, justice, to be injected and to be used, the world will be guilty. The world is guilty if they didn't transform this into justice, freedom, dignity for the Palestinians. And it's important to understand Palestinians, they don't want to delete anyone. They are asking for the most precious thing. It's the justice and the freedom for their people. It's the only nation on earth which is deprived of its freedom. And that's what we need to understand. If they believe in a human life, I want to ask the world, do we bleed as Palestinians the same blood as the Americans, as the Germans, as those Western countries? We bleed the same color. So it's time for them to stand for the humanity and to humanize, not to politicize, not to fuel the war by adding more weapons to kill the Palestinians. We need to add more human values, more dignity, more justice. We need more water to put the fire off and the war off.
Okay, you again have zoomed in on things that you have told us before here, especially when it comes to human values. And I would like to use a quote that you actually said while you held the position of a doctor, the first Palestinian doctor that held a position at an Israeli hospital. You said, "I want the Israelis not to see the Palestinians as workers working for them, or only to see them in the child who was throwing stones during the first Intifada. I want them to see the Palestinians as equal, as talented, as human, as they are. But you have Israeli officials right now who have talked about Palestinians as human animals to make Gaza a slaughterhouse. You can see where this divide is. It sounds like it's in a completely different world, the approach you have and the value that Palestinians have.
And that's what I want the Israelis and the world to see as Palestinians, to see us as a human and as equal. When I practice medicine, if you go to any hospital, whether in Iran, whether in America, whether in Canada, everywhere, all of the patients for me are equal. The only difference is the diagnosis and the type of the disease. And that's the message I want all of those political leaders from the Israeli side in particular, and the Americans and the Western countries, that they are talking about equality, human values, and they don't live by these values. They talk about it. It's time for them to walk the talk. For me, when I deliver a baby in any hospital, the only difference is not based on ethnicity, religion, color, or name. The medicine for me and health are a human equalizer, stabilizer, socializer, harmonizer, and sustainizer. Why we deliver them equally and they are the same once they are inside the hospital. But once they step outside the hospital and to give them names or the color to appear on them, we start to discriminate. It's a kind of discrimination, and discrimination is a destructive disease and it will never persist. What do you expect from the people who are discriminated against? They have to fight for their freedom, for their rights.
Well, that's the point that is important here. You have said right now that it's time for them to walk the talk. I mean, they have not done that. And in the bigger picture, when you take a look at the past 70 years or so, you see that the Palestinian issue has not been resolved. And at the same time, their rights, their restrictions, the violations, and of course their land has been chewed away and taken away from them all this time. In terms of what happened with Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, I'd like to open that up. Back in December 19, 2023, there was a Guardian Focus YouTube video. There were pictures of dead bodies that were being shown. They said, these are our nephews, our nieces, our sisters. I don't know if you remember that. At that point, the number of Palestinians that were killed, which is again December of 2023, were roughly around 10,000, a number that rose to 50,000 at this point, and maybe even more. In that context, where does peace between Israelis and Palestinians rank? How could that happen after this Operation Al-Aqsa Flood with the number of Palestinians that have been killed by the Israeli regime?
The peace, as I said to that, it's not through killing, and this will never bring safety or security to Israelis. The Israelis are less safe, secure, unless the Palestinians are free, dignified, equal, to be independent, and their safety, security is from the Palestinian safety, security, future, and the freedom. That's the most important thing. But we need the world. As you mentioned, more than 50,000 Palestinians are killed. About 70,000 Palestinians are killed. Until now, many of them are under the rubble. And who are killed? It's children. As I said, Gaza Strip has turned into a ghost, childless, parentless, homeless, lifeless, foodless, schoolless. What else is remaining? It's a crime, as I said, it's a crime against the humanity. It's the crisis of the humanity, and the world is watching it. So we need, why it's repeated, we said it, my daughters were killed in January 2009. But why it's repeated afterwards, we say never again, never again, never again. You know why it's repeated? Because lack of accountability, lack of liability. It's time for the world to stand, and Israeli administrations and leaders should be accountable to what is happening. And that's what is needed from the international community, to stand up and to speak out. And those perpetrators, those criminals, to be accountable. Accountability is the guarantee to stability and to achieve the peace we are looking for, and to follow the international institutions. Why do we have the United Nations? Why do we have the ICC? The last thing to control stability and to give stability to our world is the international institutions and the rule of law. The rule of law with one standard, not with double standards or being indifferent or selective in these rules of law. And that's what is important. That's why I said it's the test to our world to live by these values. And unless we implement and endorse these values based on rule of law, on all, the rule of law is our umbrella and it equalizes between all, not based on ethnicity or political agenda.
Okay, Doctor, you talked about accountability, which raises the question as to whether that's going to be something that can actually be achievable. I'm guessing that you obviously are talking about the Israeli regime officials. Perhaps you might be talking about the U.S. also, who's providing the assistance and the protection when it comes to Israel being shielded, for example, at the U.N. You also talk about the rule of law, but I'm sure when you talk about the rule of law in Israel, it's not something that can apply. Obviously, that, I'm guessing, is something that's a given because of what Israel has done, not only in this genocidal war, but previously in terms of violations of Palestinians. We want to figure out how it is that your approach with the reconciliation that you have recommended is actually something that is applicable right now or not, based on how the landscape has changed. Do you think that that is still something that we should strive for?
No, reconciliation, when we speak about reconciliation, what do we need? What do we mean by reconciliation? Reconciliation is to resume functionality, is the rehabilitation, to go back to the right situation, and should be based on the truth and acknowledging what is happening based on the diagnosis of the problem. The Palestinian people are under occupation, are colonized, are oppressed, are suffering, and the Israelis are occupier and oppressing. So we need to equalize with them and to end the occupation. And that's what is important. It's not just reconciliation, let us move together. There should be certain requirements to achieve it, to end the occupation, the Palestinians to get their right, to get their freedom, to get their independence. And that's what is important. Without that, it's not reconciliation. No one can coexist with a disease. No one can coexist with oppression, with occupation. We want to coexist as equal, as a free. And we can reconcile it if these needs are fulfilled. And as you said, the rule of law, I fully believe in this world, there is nothing called unconditional impunity, unconditional support. We need this support to be based on good acts. And what the Americans, as you said, the American administration is complicit in the genocide committed against the Palestinians. And what they did and the Israelis are doing are destructive to them, destructive to the Palestinians, and destructive to the world. It's time to save the world from these destructive political, really, strategic, really brutal acts. It's time. We need the rule of law and all to be accountable. And I appeal to the world, because you see it these days in the world. The world is polarized, is divided. The administrations in one side taking one side, and the public on the other side. The public is starting to be aware of what is happening and the injustices against the Palestinians.
Okay, I'd like to point to a joint poll. This poll was conducted by the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research, PSR, in Ramallah, and the International Program in Conflict Resolution and Mediation at Tel Aviv University. The results of this poll is somewhat shocking. It says that the Jewish Israelis were asked to select one of the four options that describe the Palestinians' intentions on October 7th and then the current genocide. And one of the results of the poll said that Jewish Israelis, 66% of them, selected that they want to commit genocide against Palestinians. 27% believe the aim is to conquer land and expel the Jews, the most extreme of four options. If you have 66% of Jewish Israelis who think that there should be genocide committed against Palestinians, you could imagine what Israeli officials think. Therefore, this comes to the notion as to where do we go from there? Because we have reached now in a point in this conflict where it has been taken to another level. It's not the same scenario as before.
No, it's the same continuity, because the Israeli community, the Israeli political map is moving to the right wing. It's not new. 66, even this is hopeful. 66, I thought that you would say it's 86. So I am sure they are going to the extreme right-wing government, because the current Israeli government administration is controlled by right-wing extreme fanatic government under the leadership of Netanyahu, Smotrich, Ben-Gvir, and I hear all of the incitements. What do they speak? What do they say about the Palestinians? Even the quotes they are describing the Palestinians are war criminals, are war crime against the humanity. But this is, and why all of this? We need to ask why they should be accountable to that. And what prevents accountability is the complicit and unconditional support by the American administration and the Western countries. So it's time for these countries to save the world from these self-destructive acts and the encouragement of the Israeli administration to take this path and to have it. It's a rogue administration, and that's what is happening. We need to resume trust, otherwise we live in jungle. The strong get to eat the weak. Where are we from the rule of law? So as I said, it's time for the world to stand by, and I see what happened October 7th. It didn't come out of the blue, because it has been the cumulative acts for more than seven decades. We as Palestinians, we have been suffering since the Nakba, since 1948. So it came to expose the world. And that's what happened with October 7. And I see it as an opportunity. It's a silver lining opportunity for the world to reflect on it and to understand the causes behind it, not just to blame. The root causes of it, and what can they do to make the world? We need a reform in our world.
Uh-huh. Well, you just touched on the whole issue of this program, this conversation we're having, where you talk about, if I understood you correctly, October 7th being an opportunity. The opportunity that you're talking about when it comes to the Israeli regime and the U.S. really showed itself when it comes to the U.S. President Donald Trump, who has justified the U.S. taking over the Gaza Strip, right? He's backtracked a little bit, but he wants to transform it into a real estate development. The Riviera of the Middle East is what he calls it, to build apartments on over dead bodies that are probably still below there somewhere. That's the type of rule of law that doesn't apply to this U.S. president and doesn't apply, obviously, to the Israeli regime officials. How can there be any, therefore, advancements when it comes to anything that has to deal with reconciliation between Palestinians and Israelis?
Yeah, you know, I smile when I hear this. When President Trump was elected, and they consider him elected by democratic election. But if any other country to elect someone like Trump in any other country, they would stand against the election of someone like President Trump, who is completely biased, who is fanatic, and he is leading to disturbance in our world. He wants to buy Gaza. To buy it from whom? To buy it from 2.3 million or 13 million Palestinians? From 13 million Palestinians, it's not only for one. And it's not real estate that he is dealing with that. And that's the issue of materialized world. He thinks of everything as materialized, as a developer, as construction, as a real estate. Palestine is what we call it, is a holy, sacred land. It's what we call it, Ardwaqf. Ardwaqf. No one can sell it, and it's owned by humanity, by people who own it, and no one is allowed and can give up 1 millimeter of Palestine. And that's, he has to understand it. Palestine and Gaza Strip was a Rivera before Trump was there. It was a Rivera, and Palestinian people are rooted there. It's not about the land. It's about the history, about the culture, about the memory. I can say to you about the holy people who were killed in the sake of justice, equality, freedom. The first thing when I go to Gaza, and I am waiting to go to Gaza, the first thing when I go, before I go to my home, I visit the graves of my daughters, my mother, my father. I will go to visit the graves of my sisters, my nephews, my nieces, to say to them, we didn't forget, we will never give up, we promise you, and I gave them the oath, I will never rest, I will never relax until I meet them. I am a Muslim with deep faith. I believe one day I will meet them, but to meet them with the big gift that their holy souls, noble blood, whatever waste, it was transfused, injected into a vein of hope, justice, dignity, equality, and the freedom of the Palestinian people. We all feel guilty if these holy, sacred human souls were waste.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you so much for joining us in this program. It was very enlightening, and thank you for the compassion that you delivered to us, Professor Dr. Izzadine Aboulaish. And with that, we come to an end of this edition of Unscripted. You were just listening to Professor Dr. Izzadine Aboulaish from Ikava Tafwai. Thanks for being with us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Recently, the Atlanta Federal Reserve suggested that the U.S. economy is on the course to contract in the first quarter of this year, triggering fears of a recession. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Fox News Channel has covered this story and tells us more. A former advisor and longtime supporter of the U.S. president said Donald Trump's focus on tariffs as an economic weapon is misguided, and America's economy is very wobbly. Stephen Moore said on Sunday night, 9th of March, "I think that the president's emphasis on tariffs right now is misguided. I think we have a very wobbly economy. We saw a not very good jobs report on Friday, 7th of March. The consumer confidence numbers are sinking and other indicators are not positive." Stephen Moore said, "The economy needs a pick-me-up and tariffs are not a pick-me-up. What is a Trump tax cut. Congress has to get this passed as soon as possible, by Memorial Day at the latest. That will provide the stimulus that the economy needs." Long an advocate of tax cuts, Stephen Moore is the author of the books including Trumponomics, Inside the America First Plan to Revive Our Economy. In 2019, Donald Trump picked Stephen Moore for a seat on the Federal Reserve Board. Moore eventually withdrew after a Fox News Channel reported tax and legal issues including underpayment of alimony and other outlets reported racist remarks. Stephen Moore said, "Unrelenting attacks on my character had made seeking a federal role untenable for me and my family." But he told Donald Trump he would continue to be a loud economic voice advocating your policies and would always be at your disposal. Ahead of the 2024 presidential race, Stephen Moore was a chapter co-author for Project 2025, the vast policy plan coordinated by the Hard Right Heritage Foundation that Donald Trump disavowed on the campaign trail, but which is now influencing White House policy after his victory in the race. Trump and key allies claim the U.S. economy is strong and that imposing tariffs on erstwhile allies such as Canada and Mexico, as well as competitors like China, is the right thing to do. Notwithstanding Trump's own warning to Fox News on Sunday, 9th of March, in which he said the U.S. may go into recession. On Sunday, as Trump's tariffs policy continued to heat up trade wars with Canada, Mexico, and China, Stephen Moore told Fox News host Katie Pavlich, Well, you used the word complicated, and that's exactly what it has been over the recent days, where one day the tariffs are going to go up, and then there's going to be a delay in the tariffs, and then there's going to be a tariff on another country. And it's been up and down and up and down. And by the way, the stock market went up and down and up and down with these things. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story. The Canadian province of Ontario is imposing a 25% surcharge on electricity exports to the states of New York, Michigan, and Minnesota in protest at Donald Trump's tariffs. The Ontario Premier, Doug Ford, said in a statement on Monday, 10th of March, President Trump's tariffs are a disaster for the U.S. economy. They're making life more expensive for American families and businesses. Until the threat of tariffs is gone for good, Ontario won't back down. We'll stand strong, use every tool in our toolkit, and do whatever it takes to protect Ontario. Doug Ford said the government had told the province's independent electricity system operator that any generator selling electricity to the United States was now required to add a 25% surcharge valued at $10 per megawatt hour to the cost of power. The statement said at this level, the surcharge will generate about $300,000 to $400,000 Canadian dollars a day. Ontario, the country's most populous province, has deep economic connections with the United States that would be hit hard by Donald Trump's threat of 25% tariffs. Last month, Ontario Premier Doug Ford cancelled the province's $100 million contract with Starlink, the satellite service owned by Elon Musk, who has been a key advisor to Donald Trump. The move left some remote communities without other options for how to start providing internet access to their residents. Ontario is also among several provinces to have pulled U.S. drinks off its shelves in protest against Donald Trump's tariffs, which the U.S. president has threatened against Mexico and other fellow traditional allies of the United States. Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story and tells us more. Donald Trump on Sunday, 9th of March, refused to rule out the possibility that the U.S. economy will head into recession this year and that inflation will rise, as his chaotic trade tariffs policy caused uncertainty and market turbulence. The U.S. president predicted that his economic goals would take time and a period of transition to bear fruit, but when asked in an interview on Fox News Channel's Sunday Morning Futures show, "Are you expecting a recession this year?" Donald Trump demurred. He said, "I hate to predict things like that. There is a period of transition because what we're doing is very big. We're bringing wealth back to America. That's a big thing. And there are always periods of if it takes a little time. It takes a little time, but I think it should be great for us." When asked whether he thought his tariffs on U.S. imports would fuel inflation, Trump said, "You may get it. In the meantime, guess what? Interest rates are down." He downplayed recent stock market volatility that followed his ducking and weaving over tariff policy on exports from Canada, Mexico, and China, and similar threats to other countries, despite his usual fixation with market performance in relation to the politics of the day and an appetite to claim credit when stocks rise on his watch. He said, "You have to do what's right." Recently, the Atlanta Federal Reserve suggested that the U.S. economy is on course to contract in the first quarter of this year, triggering fears of a recession that could hit the world's largest economy. In 2018, Donald Trump posted on Twitter, now X, that trade wars are good and easy.